Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. I got to give a shout out to our listener of the week, Lynette Singleton. She's our very first listener of the week. Lynette is in Atlanta, Georgia. On Twitter, she's at SCG4Nonprofits. She's been a longtime supporter of the show, frequent retweeter and live tweeter of the show. Just a very, very good friend. And we're very grateful. And that's why I say thank you very much, Lynette. And congratulations, being our first listener of the week. I'm glad you're with me. I'd be forced to endure the pain of dermatitis herpetiformis if I had heard that you had missed today's show. Online Canadian Connection. Two fundraising Canucks share online strategies from above the 49th parallel for small and mid-sized shops, including an explanation of accepting Bitcoin donations. Holly Wag is philanthropic counsel for Good Works, and Jason Shim is digital media manager at Pathways to Education Canada. We talked at the Nonprofit Technology Conference. And Right to be Forgotten. Maria Semple is paying attention to a European Court of Justice opinion that Google must remove outdated links from search results. What's the impact on your prospect research? Maria is our prospect research contributor and the prospect finder. On Tony's Take Two, a new nonprofit radio knowledge base on your board relationship. We're sponsored by Generosity Series, hosting multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Very appreciative of their support. Here's my interview from the Nonprofit Technology Conference on online giving. Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of the Nonprofit Technology Conference 2014, NTC. We are at the Marriott Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C., and with me is Jason Shim, who is Digital Media Manager for Pathways to Education Canada, and Holly Wag, Philanthropic Counsel for Good Works. Their workshop topic is the Canadian Connection, what you can learn about fundraising from people who wear toques. Holly, Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Did you feel that Canada doesn't get sufficient representation, that you had to explicitly create a workshop called Learn From Us Above the 49th Parallel?
I would say so.
You getting short shrift, or do you think so?
Yeah, I would totally say so. And we also thought that Americans should know what toques are, and that's a really important cultural piece of education.
Okay, now toques, the word is spelled T-O-Q-U-E-S.
Correct.
I'll go ahead, Jason, why don't you explain what a toque is?
A toque is a Canadian winter hat, a traditional Canadian winter hat.
And what do they look like?
They look like all sorts of things. Like, so some of them, you know, they just have, you pull it down, and some of them may have flaps, some of them may have, like, pom-poms, but generally they just pull over and...
They're knitted, generally.
Yeah.
Knitted, okay. So they're in place of a hood. I'm seeing those in New York City. I'm seeing a fair number of toques. I saw one, well, adorable one, had little ears, mm-hmm. little fur ears.
Yep.
So a toque. Yeah.
So it's the difference between America, some places, that would be for style, and ours are definitely for survival.
Okay. And where are each of you from in Canada?
Toronto.
Toronto, okay.
And I'm from Ottawa.
Ottawa. Toronto is Ontario,
yep.
And Ottawa is... Also, like, Ontario? No.
Yeah.
It is.
And what else is Ottawa? Do you know?
What else is Ottawa?
The capital of Canada.
I didn't know. All right. See how bad?
And yeah. See, now you know why the Canadians are at 14 NTC.
All right. I was thinking of auto manufacturing. So is Ottawa an auto manufacturing center?
No, totally. Government city. 40% of our population are government employees.
Okay. All right. We're learning. But I toques I knew. But the capital I did not. Okay, what can we learn? So you each work for nonprofits, Pathways to Education Canada, and Good Works, and you have some lessons that you can share for those of us down south here.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to go first? I'll leave it to you.
Oh, do you want me to go first? Okay. So,
go ahead, Holly.
Good Works is actually, I'm a fundraising consultant now.
So. Right.
No, that's not a problem. So we work with a variety of not-for-profits across the country. We work with, like, national healthcare charities, international charities. We also work with local hospital foundations or social services. And when I came away from N10 last year, I was really aware of what all of these cool things that other Americans were doing, and they would say it didn't work. And I'm like, but what are you talking about? Like, in Canada, that's actually really good. So, for example, I heard a lot of people dissing the phone and saying, you know, telemarketing doesn't work, or we're not getting the good numbers, or don't invest there. And it got me to thinking, you know, some of the differences between Canadian and American fundraising. And there definitely is in the direct mail market, how we do our asks and how we structure our letters. Like, Canadians are just a little bit more polite and less forthright in asking for money. But it was amazing to me going back to the phone to see that I could acquire online donors, and I'm seeing on the phone, you know, 5 to 10% conversion rates, which nobody else was seeing here. So the question is the phone a bad tool, or are you just hiring a bad vendor?
Yeah. Okay. So. Okay. Jason?
And I work for Pathways to Education Canada, and we're an organization that focuses on lowering the dropout rate among youth who are living in economically disadvantaged areas. And
so it's the high school dropout rate?
Yes.
Do you have an equivalent? Is it high school and then higher ed? Same as in the States?
Yep. Yes. It goes 9 to 12, and then college or university afterwards.
Okay.
And I was finding that, you know, when I was doing presentations focused on youth and talking about the technology adoption and things, that, you know, the numbers that we were seeing in the U.S. Were lower compared to Canada. And historically, you know, for adoption for things like Facebook, that the adoption rate among youth has been quite a bit higher. And, you know, I don't know if it's because, you know, we're just more spread out and we use more, you know, the technology to connect with one another. Like, it's just pure speculation on my part. But in terms of numbers-wise, like, you know, technology or Facebook adoption among youth was, you know, in the upper 90%, whereas at the time at the U.S. it was closer, you know, about the 80-ish percent among high school students. So that also influences how, you know, we do our work, in that, you know, it's we have to be on Facebook to interact with our youth, and but it also is much more readily apparent when making policy and trying to convince people that, you know, Facebook is the way to go when dealing with youth. And but it's neat because, you know, we're able to run these projects that essentially it's where the U.S. may be in some technological respects in, you know, 3 or 4 years, and we can just, you know, give everyone a heads up, because, you know, generally what has happened in the technology realm, you know, ends up happening in the U.S. a few years later in terms of, like, adoption-related kind of things.
Oh, really? Is that how you see trends go?
I think so. Like, I mean, Google recently had a program called Google Partners that was geared towards their advertisers, and their pilot audience initially was in Canada. And, I mean, it makes sense because it's a small, like, you know, relative to the population of some entire states. I mean, you know, population of Canada, what is it, like?
35 million.
35 million, yeah. And yeah, that it provided a place where, you know, they could test it out and make sure that the communities were, you know, well-serviced, and that people could provide feedback. And they made sure that everything worked for the Canadians before they released it to all of the U.S. audience as well. And, I mean, from a nonprofit perspective, I mean, it's not like you can necessarily, you know, go pilot nonprofit projects in Canada before deploying them to the U.S. But I think when looking at broader technology trends and how some Canadian nonprofits have adapted to things, that, you know, there can be some lessons that can be learned from the Canadians north of the border.
Okay, and we're gonna talk in detail about what those lessons are. And I'm learning here. 35 million in the entire country. I mean, that's about the population of California or something.
We're actually going to research that tonight, so that's good. I was laughing because I'm speaking this afternoon on a different topic about email, and one of the panelists I was speaking with was originally supposed to be Danny Boo from the American Cancer Society, and so he was talking about the size of his list, and he said it was around 15 million people, and I started laughing, and
so
I was like, it's half my country. That's actually probably like the eligible age of everybody you can actually donate over 18. So I was like, wow, like, you know. So when we're also coming here, you know, you've come to this conference, and a lot of the people who are presenting are often from really big organizations who are really well resourced. And so I thought it was really interesting that our definition of a small or a medium not-for-profit, and for the purposes of our thing, we were kind of saying, like, under $500,000 annually in fundraising revenue, you'd be small, and between $500,000 and $2.5 million be medium. But okay, I don't know if many organizations here, if I said, well, this organization's raising $2.1 million through their entire fundraising program, they would probably be like, that's really small. But it's not necessarily in Canada. So
yeah, well, be careful. Now, in the U.S., I'm pretty sure it's just around 50% of the nonprofits, I think it's like 51% or something, have annual budgets of under $50,000.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
So I mean, it's
And our audience here, Nonprofit Radio, is all small and mid-sized shops. I know that I'm not talking to, and I don't produce the show for Stanford University or Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital or any of these huge organizations, although I do think they could benefit. But it's their lives.
Yeah.
They're missing out. I can't reform them. The vast majority of nonprofits are small by your definition, and I'm pretty sure it's like 51% have annual budgets under $50,000.
That's crazy, because there's about 85,000 charities in Canada, and half of those don't even have a staff member. Like, they're all entirely volunteer driven. So even the context that we're talking about, we're guaranteeing at least that these people have one staff member, or at least organized enough to have some sort of fundraising program of some shape.
You're not really very aware of what's happening in the U.S. Do you know the U.S. Capitol?
I'm in it, thank goodness.
Oh, you are.
But I didn't know about the mall,
because
everybody kept on talking about the mall.
Oh, you figured shopping?
Yeah, and I was like, why would everybody want to come to the mall? And then I realized it was not about a shopping center. Embarrassing, but there
okay.
You go.
All right. Holly, let's stay with you. And so you're each working either in a small mid-sized organization, Jason, or supporting them as a consultant, Holly. So what are some of the technology lessons that we can bring from above?
I think one of my favorite lessons, because our agency we have a direct mail history. So one of the reasons why I was hired is to build the digital side of our business. And what's amazing to me is nobody that I work with has anything that's integrated or even a comprehensive systems approach to like capture their data or even an email program. So I'm really struggling with organizations who know that they need to, for example, I need to have an email program. I need to be able to get people to sign up on my website. So part of what we do is teaching them and coaching or executing it for them, depending what the scope of work is. But a lot of it is change management and culture management within organizations, like a hospital foundation.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Bonjour, this is Dominique Decoq.
Bonjour, c'est Tamara Zuboff.
Bonjour, c'est Asania Kone.
We are hosting Pardon My French New York City.
Our guests come from all over the world.
From Mali to New Caledonia, from Paris to Quebec.
French is a common language, yet they all come from different cultures, backgrounds or countries.
And their common desire is to make New York their home.
Listen to them share their stories.
Join us at Pardon My French New York City every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Let's work with an example of a client that unattributed, but how not just what you did, not just how you help them generally, but how you help specifically, and what the lessons can be for small and mid-sized shops here.
One of the clients that I've worked with, and they will see, which I think is an awesome case study, is that they've only had an online program, and all that online program really evolves around is email, nothing else. And so they, for the first time, will see probably this year their online revenue surpass their direct mail revenue, and their direct mail revenue was pretty healthy to begin with. And some of the lessons when I came in was being able to, for example, we had a big bulk list of people, but we had no idea who was actually on our email list. We didn't know where they came from. We didn't know if they were donors, if they were supporters, what kind of information. And so one of my first techniques is sort of to go in, you have to find out what information is of value to your supporters. You have to find out, you know, where they're coming from, what they want. So we'll work with our charities to really understand who their donors are. And one of the things that we're really big on is storytelling works exceptionally well.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. And so we will help our clients find a story that will resonate with donors and then translate that and help them tell that story in an email medium. So
how do you pick the right stories?
I use this very unscientific. I will use a shiver test or the cry test. So if I read a story or...
What was it for? Oh, shiver.
A shiver test.
Cry I got. Okay.
Cry. But so if I hear of a story that stops and makes me pause and makes me feel like it punches me in the gut, then I know that that is the absolute right story for me. And so, you know, part of, you know, sometimes I'm talking to the person to get the story. Sometimes I'm developing it, you know, off paper. And so for me, it's teaching not-for-profits how to write a good story in an email. And I think storytelling is key, but I also think regular communications is something that small not-for-profits really struggle with. They're like, all these big organizations, they say they send out, you know, 30 emails or, you know, 5 emails a month. And we start planning out a schedule so that they don't all get bulked out. But like, let's say we're going to do 1 email a month and it's just going to be telling about something in your organization that's really important. So, for example, one of the organizations I volunteer with is called the Ten Oaks Project, and we run summer camps for kids who have queer parents. And so we were never telling any of our donors what we were doing with their money. And so this year we have a planned series of 6 stories that we captured, and sometimes they're campers. So talking about, you know, one girl I just finished writing her story, her name is Bernadette, and she talked about the moment when she was at school and she found out that her friends had passed around a petition asking her to be kicked out of the girls' change room phys ed because her parents were gay. And they presumed that she was going to be making, you know, sexual passes at her. I mean, how does that story not kick you in the gut, right? To feel like this kid who at that time was in grade 7.
And so this is a bunch of kids doing it.
A bunch of kids and her finding out. And so really talking about the role that this organization has played in transforming and building her self-confidence and her self-esteem and, you know, helping her to successfully grow up and building this community of peers. So for us in that organization, we've decided every other month we tell one of those stories. So they're camper stories, they're family stories, they're volunteer. And the commonality between all of them is that look you just got on your face, Tony, was that getting kicked out by your peers. Because it really, people understand why they're giving to this. They were there themselves. They can relate to that, or they know that that's a really important issue. And so my job with everyone we work is to find that kind of moment and tell it well.
That's just remarkable. And kids becoming so bigoted at that age. Kids becoming bigoted, period.
Yeah, it's horrific. And this is and this is Canada, and we pride ourselves, you know, on diversity and tolerance. So I can't even imagine what would happen in places that, you know, aren't as progressive as ours is.
So finding that compelling story. How do you encourage the storyteller to open up? Maybe you hear about the story from program staff, for instance, some other way. How do you induce the person to share personally?
Well, actually, surprisingly, the best way to interview someone is over the phone. And you wouldn't necessarily think that, but because of that little bit of distance between you and the person, they often just open up. And it's taking them through a journey through their questions and ask. And you should always, when you're interviewing someone, ask the kind of leading questions if they're not giving you what you want. But, you know, you ask them about a situation and you say, tell me how that make you feel. If they're describing a situation, tell me what it sounded like. Tell me what it smelled like, you know? And you really want to get into the sensory processes when you're interviewing that person. And sometimes a person will just go and they'll tell you a story. It's an hour and it'll be your job to cut it back. And sometimes it's making them really comfortable and making points of identification with them. And the skill I think that you develop as a fundraiser over time is that people actually tell me really everything, like really candid, because I'm a very honest and open person. And I think that relates through and they're really comfortable being transparent with me. So it's kind of a gift. You know, you might be a really good fundraiser if you have a natural gift for having people disclose very personal things to you.
Yeah. Okay. Your advice about interviewing people on the phone reminds me of Terry Gross, who's the host of a national public radio show, Fresh Air.
Yeah.
She insists that her guests not be in the studio with her. They're always remote, and not just in another room, but they're in other cities. She doesn't want them. She doesn't want to be looking at them. She feels she gets a better connection just having their voice in her head, and same for them.
Exactly.
It's unusual, but it works perfectly well for her.
But it's not, because 80% of communication is nonverbal. All of the body language, all of the facial discomfort, maybe if somebody's telling you something that upsets you, none of that translates through. All you have to do is control your voice with absolutely no judgment as they're sharing these really important transformational moments that your cause or your organization has had in your life. And there's really nothing more beautiful or a privilege to get to talk to these people who talk about how X organization helped their wife die, or to talk about how they were able to get a mastectomy and then an immediate breast reconstruction at a hospital because of a piece of equipment that donors have purchased, how they were able to get refugee status and come to Canada, about how they donated a kidney to their brother so he could live. It's a privilege to be able to hear those stories.
Jason, on the education side, what can we learn from up above?
Well, a project that I was working on last year was the implementation of Bitcoin donations at our nonprofit. And within the nonprofits, it is across North America, or indeed like around the world, it's quite unique because it's something that is perceived to be, it requires a lot of technical sort of implementation, but it's actually quite straightforward. But it was further supplemented by the fact that the Canadian government issued very quickly after Bitcoin came out an advisory saying, hey, this is how we deal with the tax implications of Bitcoin and currency. And that provided guidance for people to start implementing it within their organizations and things. So in November, we became the first organization in Canada to issue tax receipts for Bitcoin donations. And I would like to go as far to say that the first organization in North America to issue tax receipts. I have yet to find a U.S. organization that issues it.
Before we go much further, which we do have time for, but we better acquaint listeners with what Bitcoin is all about.
Right.
I think a lot of people have heard of it. Very few people use it.
Yeah.
Let's flesh that out for people.
And how you get it and it translates into real money, because I still don't really
understand
that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. How does it translate to real money, too? So please tell us the story of what Bitcoin's about.
So in a nutshell, a Bitcoin is an online cryptocurrency that... I would use the analogy of imagine if you had to give someone who lived on the other side of the country $5. Now, the options that may be available to you is you could mail that $5 to them. You could maybe send them a bank transfer. You could send it to them via PayPal. But all of that, with the exception of emailing an actual $5 bill, requires a central authority. So, with your bank, you would say, minus Jason $5, plus Tony $5, and the bank would be in control of that, or PayPal would do the same thing as part of their central ledger.
Okay.
But imagine a system similar to the internet where it's peer-to-peer and no one actually has direct control as to whether or not the transaction goes through, that it is the closest thing to cash that is electronically available. So if I want to send you $5, there's no one in between that could stop that transaction, that it's as good as me giving you the cash. There's no government agency or organization or company that could block the transaction, which is the system that currently exists. Now, it's quite a revolutionary concept, similar to the internet, in which, before the internet, people accessing like bulletin board systems that you're dialing into a central server, and people post messages, but if someone doesn't like you being there, they could kick you out. But the magic of the internet being that anyone can communicate with anyone else in the world, and if people can't say that this piece of data isn't entering my country, like at least with the ideals of net neutrality. So imagine that applied to a financial system. And it's quite a revolutionary concept that, you could be sending, large sums of money.
What am I actually transferring? What do you get? Or what do I get when you're giving me this $5?
Yeah.
What do I see?
You would see just a whole bunch of code. So Bitcoin is transferred to what's called wallets. And these are usually expressed in QR codes. So you would get a wallet that would essentially be a QR code that people could deposit into.
And of course, the QR code is those little black and white diagrams that are scannable and lead to websites.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you wanted to generate Bitcoin, so this is something that's created by the network. So every computer that is part of the Bitcoin network is actually helping facilitate these transactions. And in return for helping facilitate these transactions and being the network, the Bitcoin program or algorithm itself will give those computers that are transferring everything like small bits of Bitcoin. So it's sort of like an incentive system to keep the network flowing and everything. And it's designed in such a way that you can't just like manufacture more money, like, you know, just you can't just print more Bitcoin or create more Bitcoin. It's at a preset rate that, you know, it distributes at a set amount, and there can only ever be like 21 million Bitcoin in the system. And yeah.
Okay. I do have a couple questions, but we don't really have time to go into any more detail about Bitcoin. We'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry, listeners, about Bitcoin. Because we want to get to the technology lessons from Jason. All right, so now we have some grounding in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Let's get to the your takeaway.
In terms of implementation, I mean, this is a technology. Like we chose to pursue it because the Canadian government itself, through the Royal Canadian Mint, they've been working on a project called the Mint Chip. Now, this is a government-backed project that they are pursuing digital currency. So imagine. The way that they've structured it is, you know, the ideal science fiction ideal of, you know, you tap two cards together and you can transfer the money straight there. So there's no such thing anymore as like $5 bills or $10 bills that, you know, you could just touch the two cards together and it's just a currency transfer. No bank in between to do that. And when we look ahead, I think one of the absolutes will be like currency will change. That's the way that things will be moving, like in terms of we're moving from cash systems to electronic systems, you know, like things like PayPal. This is the next natural evolution of currency transfer. So whether it was Bitcoin or anything else, you know, that was the rationale that we used to pursue it, because the Canadian government's already exploring digital currency. So Bitcoin came out, which, you know, aims to be a global kind of currency. Mm-hmm. So why not pursue it? So we, you know, went through the process of implementing it. It was actually quite straightforward. And there's a great fund online, actually. It's called the Bitcoin 100. And it's a fund that was developed by early Bitcoin adopters. And they put a whole bunch of Bitcoin into a wallet. And I think they started off with something like over $100,000. And they said, if a nonprofit is interested in exploring Bitcoin and implements it for their nonprofit and puts the QR code on the website, we'll just give them $1,000.
Oh.
And it's the simplest $1,000 that I think the organization has ever received. Like, you just let them know that, hey, we're accepting Bitcoin. And no grant proposal. They just sent the $1,000 and be like, okay, well, have a nice day. And I was like, oh, do you want to follow up on that? And he was like, no, just the best thing you can do for me is help me get rid of this fund, because the money is growing faster than I can spend it. Like, sort of your ideal philanthropist.
Right? Yeah, right.
But
This was only available to Canadian nonprofits?
No, the gentleman is actually based out of Maryland. His name is Dimitri, and he runs the fund. So he's acts as a community trustee for this fund that was built around an online forum. So, you know, he's charged with, you know, distributing.
And how can we find him?
Just Google Bitcoin 100, and I believe the website is bitcoin100.org. Just let him know that you're interested in getting the $1,000, and, you know, he should follow up. And,
okay. That's actually an excellent takeaway, because now we have a site we can go to, we can learn more about Bitcoin and the possibility of accepting it, and, of course, the bigger takeaway being the transformation. Well, I was thinking, there's $1,000. But I was thinking of I was thinking a little broader, Holly, than that. There's a little more profound thought that Jason had, which was the transformation of currency.
Yeah, and I think that's where it will happen. I can't say what the timeline will be. I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, flying cars, and digital currencies.
Your grandchildren.
Yeah.
Okay. Those are excellent. All right, two very good lessons and things to think about. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Jason. Jason Shim is a digital media manager for Pathways to Education Canada, and Holly Wagg, philanthropic counsel for the consulting firm Good Works. I want to thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. You are listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of the Nonprofit Technology Conference, NTC 2014. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, N10 and NTC. Generosity Series sponsors Nonprofit Radio, and they help me make it. They help make it possible for me to go to conferences like NTC and to get valuable info for you from interviews like that. Generosity Series hosts multi-charity peer-to-peer runs and walks. You know them. You've heard me talk about them. If you're thinking about including a run or a walk in your fundraising, I ask you to check them out as a possible provider. Tell Dave Lynn that you're from Nonprofit Radio. He's the COO. You can reach Dave Lynn at 718-506-9777 or generosityseries.com. Many thanks to them for their support of Nonprofit Radio. I have a new Nonprofit Radio knowledge base. This one is on your board relationship. I know that lots of charities are struggling with their relationship with boards and board members. Just yesterday, I had lunch with a CEO and a board member who were sharing their frustrations with their underperforming board. I've got links to Nonprofit Radio interviews on getting the best out of your trustees. There's a panel of three women who work in nonprofits talking about that. Building a more effective board with Gail Gifford. Working with your small organization board. That was another panel. Board basics with Gene Takagi. And a couple of other links also. All about your relationship with your board and getting the most out of your board. The video and the links are at TonyMartinetti.com. That is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 13th of June, 24th show of 2014. You know Maria Semple. She's the Prospect Finder. She's a trainer and speaker on prospect research. Her website is theprospectfinder.com, and her book is Panning for Gold, Find Your Best Donor Prospects Now! She's our doyen of Dirt Cheap and Free. You can follow Maria on Twitter at Maria Semple. Welcome back, Maria. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. You're not going to say glad to be here or anything?
Well, I am glad to be here, actually, and it's a nice summer month, and I'm always happy in the summer, so this is a good thing.
Oh, excellent. And even happier on a nonprofit radio day, right?
Absolutely.
Now that I've pimped you twice, you have no choice but to say yes, and I'm happy and everything else. We're talking about the right to be forgotten. This came from a Spaniard who brought a case in the European Court of Justice.
Yes, so, you know, I thought it was very interesting, and I was wondering, you know, there might not be immediate implications for prospect researchers in the United States, but, you know, it got me to thinking what implications this might have 5 or 10 years down the line in terms of information that might end up getting erased from Google searches. And it just got me to wondering, you know, how we have to maybe cross-check data in other places, especially going forward if we're going to start seeing data, you know, become erased.
Yeah. It could even be more imminent than 5 or 10 years, I think.
It very well could be. You know, right now, one of the stats that I had seen was that over 41,000 Europeans have actually asked through this online form that Google has created to be forgotten. So they want mention of themselves erased off of Google search results, and that's huge.
Let's set the scene in case everyone hasn't heard of this. This was a man in Spain who brought a case to the European Court of Justice because there were links in searches of his name. This is just searching his name. There were links to old events that he thought were no longer relevant.
Right. It had to do with a real estate auction that was held to settle some of what they call social security debts, whatever that meant.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, you know, not happy that that was still out there because he felt that the debts had been settled and so forth. And so he petitioned through this Europe's top court, which is the Court of Justice of the European Union. I guess it's somewhat similar to our Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And petitioned, and it was ruled in his favor that, yes, Google is going to have to comply. So, of course, if Google's going to have to comply, you have to think that the other major search engines like Yahoo and Microsoft Bing will also have to do the same.
And to comply, Google came up with this online form. I don't know if you can. I don't know how you go directly to the form. I guess you can just search it.
I ended up finding a link in one of the articles that led me directly to the form, and it's pretty interesting because you actually have to select from a drop-down menu one of the 32 countries that are listed that you would reside in. You do need to provide some sort of a photo ID so that, I guess, you know, if you're trying to get maybe, say, a competitor's information swiped or something like that, they want to make sure that, yes, you're the person, then it's information about you, et cetera. And so there are, you know, there's certain things that you do need to do in order to comply to get it, to get the data removed. But they really think it's going to be a very long time before Google can even get through all of these requests.
And right now it only pertains to the European Union, as you said, the 32 countries. So this does not apply to U.S. residents. But it could. There's potential that someone could bring a similar action and similarly succeed in the U.S.
I'm not. I would not put it past somebody to come up with that idea. Having read, you know, all the press that there is available out there about this particular ruling in Europe. One thing that I didn't realize. I mean, I just thought that you go to Google.com and that's just the one place to do research. But evidently, there's a Google.co.uk, which is, I guess, the European equivalent of Google's search engine. So I think what they're, from my understanding of what I've read, is that it's going to wipe clean the search results that you would find on the European search engine and maybe not necessarily Google.com. Again, it's all so new and all such a gray area, and Google themselves is trying to figure out how they're going to end up complying with this whole thing.
The implications then for prospect research are becoming apparent as we're talking. You might not find everything that you'd like to find on someone.
Right, right. And, you know, I can give you an example, Tony, of a search I was doing a number of years back, probably about 10 years ago. I was doing some donor research. Actually, I was just doing research. I wasn't sure that this person was actually considered a donor prospect or not, because sometimes I'm doing the research because they're considering having this person as a high-profile board member. And so I'm doing the research, and I kept coming up with this person's name connected to corporate insider trading. So the bad kind of insider trading. And at first I dismissed it because I thought, well, maybe it's just the same name. But then I came across one article that actually did link the person to the insider trading and linked the person to current employment situation. So then I knew this was indeed the prospect. So I came. I had a dilemma because, right, if I put this information into a written profile, then any donor prospect, really has the right to walk into your organization and say, show me what information you've compiled on me. I want to see my donor record. And so I really had this dilemma, and I thought, well, what do I do with this information? So I decided to call the person who had hired me to do the research, and I asked, why are you having me do this research on this individual? Is it for a simple donation, or is there something more to this? And she said, oh, there's a lot more to it. We are considering bringing him on the board, and our board chair thinks he would make a great treasurer for our organization.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So that was, you know, I thought, okay, well, red flag. So I decided to verbally give the information that I'd found. I mentioned that the person had paid their fines, had done their time. It was well in their past, but I did feel that the executive director did need to know that this existed.
Now, why? This is a really interesting dilemma, but why just verbally? Why? I mean, if it's bona fide and you had confirmed it, why not put it in the written prospect report?
Well, we discussed that. I told her that I would. I don't like to put information into a written profile that would potentially potentially sever a relationship with somebody. And it could, it was a potentially great relationship that could have existed. So I did not want to eliminate that possibility for her if he'd read this and said, well, you know, this was dug up on me and, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this and I'm walking away from this organization. Clearly it was in his past. Everything had, you know, all fines had been paid, and as I said, mm-hmm. all time had right. been served. Right. I just felt that it could end up severing the relationship ultimately, and I didn't want to sever a relationship before it even began, since there may not have been any issues in the future. I just told her to tread carefully.
You always have in the back of your mind what the donor or donor prospect might think if they were to read this in the organization's report that you had written?
Yeah, it was. It, absolutely. Yeah.
You're always, always thinking about
that. For that same reason, I don't like to delve into divorce records.
Yeah, well, no, I can see how that wouldn't belong. But, all right, it's just interesting. You always have this in mind, that what would happen if the person were to read this about themselves in the in the organization's files. You're always thinking about
always.
That. Okay, interesting. And what happened in that case? Did they end up inviting the person to be on the board, do you know, or did they not?
They did. They ultimately did.
Okay.
But I don't think they put him in a treasurer position immediately. Or I'm not sure down the line if that ended up coming to fruition, but it was certainly at least something that the executive director needed to be aware of.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent story. Thank you. This all, sort of brings up also the potential. The discretion, really, that Google is going to have and other search engines as they have to comply with this. The way I read the description I read, I didn't read the court's decision itself, but the description I read was that, you know, there's some vague description or vague direction about what Google should consider inappropriate and what not, but nothing's very, very specific. And so that leaves a lot of discretion for Google as to whether something like what you described still belongs. I mean, it still could be very relevant, even though it's in the past. You know, I mean, history is all in the past. We're studying history all the time. So just because something is in the past, Google and detrimental to the person, Google could still very well determine that belongs under that person's search results.
Right. So now people are wondering, as a matter of fact, I read an article that was in a May 15th edition of USA Today where, you know, they talked about, that the court basically is blaming the messenger. And, you know, this person had this, you know, these situations in their past. Google is simply giving you access to the information. And, if reputations can now be somehow, you know, as they're calling it in this article, airbrushed on demand, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have to think about, you know, well, if people who have done things, you know, maybe doctors who have botched surgeries, and you know,
sure.
you just think about the implications of all the types of people that we'd be thinking about having this shady past erased.
There's just a scary amount of discretion that Google has, because the past is still relevant, but maybe some things are irrelevant. How do you decide what's relevant to other people and what's not? The other very interesting thing about this is the information isn't going away. It's not going to be removed from the internet, if that's even possible. It's just going to be removed from a search result with that from of that person's name. So the info
exactly.
is not.
As a matter of fact, the very newspaper articles that this Spaniard, was upset about, still exist on the internet.
Yeah.
More people have probably read the articles now than otherwise would have ever read them if he hadn't brought this to court. And so the articles still exist. It's just that getting to the articles by searching on this individual's name is something that has been or will be very soon. I'm not sure if it was removed or not, but I think it maybe it was at this point. So data is probably still going to exist, but as a prospect researcher, your main starting point is always with a person's name.
Yes, yes. Okay.
That's why I was wondering how this was really going to affect donor research. I mean, we have a lot of institutions, particularly higher ed, that do their research. Donors who reside in Europe, right? So you've got people who come to this country for their education,
yes,
and they go back, or people who started, you know, as a U.S. citizen and are now living as expats in another country. So, you know, the borders being as fluid as they are, you can imagine, you know, maybe a very small social service organization, nonprofit, might not be in that situation as they're researching their donors, because for the most part they're serving a geographic region and their donors come from that very smaller pool of people. But larger organizations that serve or that are international, and it doesn't even have to be a higher ed. Imagine the Y's of the world or United Ways.
We have to go out for a break. When we come back, Maria and I are going to keep talking about this, and we're going to move to the subject of the donor's right to privacy and the code of ethics around prospect research. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at MontyTaylor.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Talking Alternative Radio. 24 hours a day.
Lively conversation.
Top trends.
Sound advice.
That's Tony Martinetti.
Yeah, that's Tony Martinetti.
Nonprofit radio. And I'm Travis Frazier from United Way of New York City.
And I'm Michelle Walsh from the U.S. Fund for UNICEF.
And I'm Tony Martinetti, and with me is Maria Semple, the Prospect Finder. Maria, APRA, the Association of Prospect Researchers for Advancement, they have something to say about donor privacy.
They do. They actually, on their website, a statement of ethics, and I'd be glad to provide that link to your listeners, Tony, on your Facebook page.
Okay, we'll put that after the takeaways, yes?
Yep, sure. And so the main page is aprahome.org, aprahome.org. And so there, you know, that is the association that most professional prospect researchers would align with and rely on for their professional development. So there is a statement of ethics that APRA has, and, you know, accountability and practice as well. I mean, I'm looking at one specific line that they have in their code of ethics around practice. It says that, you know, they shall only record data that is appropriate to the fundraising process and protect the confidentiality of all personal information at all times. So, you know, they take donor privacy very seriously and make sure that information is safeguarded at their organizations. Password protect the donor software, for example, making sure that only people who need access to that information are going to get the access to the information.
Well, let's go back to this donor, the confidentiality. I mean, how do you protect the person's confidentiality when your task is to prepare research about the person? I mean, at the top of the page is the person's name, and the pages are loaded with stuff about the person. How do they balance? What do they mean there? Protect confidentiality.
So you want to make sure that only the people who need access to this information to advance fundraising are going to have access to the information. First of all, the information is all derived from publicly available sources, right?
Okay.
So Google, obviously, is one of those publicly available sources that we get information from.
We've talked about hundreds of those on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you go to a lot of different sources to gather the information and bring it all together. The role of the prospect researcher is to take all of that information, wade through it, and come up with a concise profile. Most of the time, the information is going to be embedded right into the donor record, because then you can pull the reports, you know, as you need in the donor software. When I'm preparing the profiles, I just do it in a Word document so that they can easily cut and paste the information in if need be at their end, because obviously I don't have access to donor software that my clients are using.
So you want to be sensitive to then who you're emailing these to? I don't mean you as the prospect. Well, I don't mean you personally, but the prospect researcher, and they may very well in a smaller mid-sized shop not even be devoted to prospect research. So the person doing this research on donors and potential donors, you want to be very conscious of who you're emailing these reports to, who has access to the nested folders where these prospect reports are stored.
Yes, absolutely. And then you can imagine a situation where you get your development committee together and you're doing perhaps some sort of peer review sessions. So you might have printed profiles or data, pieces of data pertaining to these individuals on the table. You know, every development office really should have a good shredder in the office, and I would really encourage people not to allow board members and other volunteers involved in the development process to walk out with hard copies, because you just don't want this information, you know, floating around out there.
That's a very good admonition and caution. Where the hard copies go. I mean, then they end up in the person's office or home or something. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Talking about shredders, you know, I can't stand seeing those shredders where it's like quarter-inch strips. Like a four-year-old could put those back together if they wanted to. Those quarter-inch long strips. I mean, you should get at least cross-cut, if not the ones that make those little paper, tiny bullets, which are supposed to be impossible to put back together.
Right. And there are companies that you can hire, depending on how much you really have to shred. There are companies that you can hire to do shredding. I think that even in local companies like the UPS stores, they have shredders located within those facilities, maybe even Staples. I'm not sure. I know UPS does. But, you know, there are places that you can go then and take it and have it securely shredded. So that might be something to consider if you do have an awful lot. Maybe your offices are moving and suddenly you find that, okay, you've got files and files from maybe past years and now things are going all electronic. What are you going to do with all of this? You don't want to move it, right, because you might not need to bring all of that old data with you, but yet it contains some potentially, you know, sensitive information that people would not want just floating around out there.
Yes, and as you mentioned, there are services where they'll just place a bin in your office, and then when it fills up, you call them, and then they come and shred it, and they give you back the empty bin. What else are you thinking about? We have just about another minute or so. What else around this data privacy and confidentiality?
Well, again, just making sure that everything is very well password protected. Only allow people to have access to the donor software, to your donor database that absolutely need it. Shred anything that is printed, and keep on top of what's happening with this particular law that occurred in the European Union. And just, you know, maybe, you know, I will of course keep on top of it, Tony, and we can maybe revisit it as things develop. Even if we make it part of a small piece of a future show, but I think that nonprofits do need to be aware that this is out there and see the potential for its effect in the United States.
And you'll be most successful, I think, in searching if you look for Right to Be Forgotten. Maria, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
My pleasure. Maria Semple, The Prospect Finder. On Twitter, she's at Maria Semple. Her site is theprospectfinder.com. Next week, Cindy Gibson, our grants fundraising contributor, on the Logic Model. And Deborah Sharp from Nonprofit Technology Conference on user personas. If you missed any of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is our line producer. The show's social media is by Julia Campbell of J. Campbell Social Marketing. And the remote producer of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio is John Federico of The New Rules. Our music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Hi, I'm Austin Marola.
And I'm Sloan Wainwright.
We're the hosts of the new Thursday morning show, The Music
Power Hour
at 11 a.m.
We're going to have fun.
And shine the light on all aspects of music.
And its limitless healing possibilities.
We're going to invite artists to share their songs and play live.
We'll be listening and talking about great music from yesterday to today.
So you're invited to share in our musical conversation.
Your ears will be delighted with the sound of music.
And our voices. Join Austin.
And Sloan.
Live Thursdays at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at MontyTaylor.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
TalkingAlternative.com.